From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
For 20 years, I was reviled in prison as a triple murderer. For 20 years, I feared for my life every single day. For 20 years, I was condemned by history, repudiated by the courts, and left to die amid the squalor and squander of a maximum security prison. And just 3 weeks ago, I was invited to the White House.
Today, Reuben Hurricane Carter. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Prisoners who were beaten and tortured by law enforcement officers at Attica in upstate New York in 1971 were awarded $8 million in a compensation settlement yesterday. The four-day siege at the prison, which cost the lives of 11 guards and 32 prisoners, ended with state troopers storming the facility. 80 people were wounded. It became the deadliest prison brutality incident in the nation's history, and this is what it sounded like at the time.
Governor Rockefeller and prison officials provoked a police riot which caused the deaths of 41 persons and the shootings and beatings of hundreds more. We hereby call for the indictment of Governor Rockefeller, Commissioner Oswald, Deputy Commissioner Dunbar, Warden and Warden Mancusi, and Deputy Warden Vincent for assault, mayhem, and murder.
A report on Pacifica Station WBAI in 1971. Israel began transferring 5% of the West Bank to Palestinian control today after negotiators ended a seven-week deadlock over whether the Palestinians could have a say in what areas will be handed over. The withdrawal started around midday when several trucks loaded with furniture and mattresses rolled out of the Yosef Army Air Base east of the West Bank's largest town of Nablus. The Army was to transfer a total of 6 bases and camps in the northern and southern West Bank, and the pullback was to be completed tomorrow. As part of the agreement, Israel is handing 3% of the West Bank to Palestinian civil rule and another 2% to sole Palestinian control. Chechen fighters launched a strong counterattack against Russian forces in Grozny's northern outskirts today, despite Moscow's claims that the rebels were close to collapse. Rebel fighters retook parts of the Grozny suburb of Khankhala, which Russian forces claimed to have occupied days ago. By this morning, Chechen militants controlled the southern half of the area. Chechen leaders said the attacks marked the start of a change in the war, adding that the Russian advance into Chechnya would be halted. A major Chechen counterattack could be embarrassing to the Russian government, which has claimed it's close to defeating the rebels. Former Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet underwent an independent medical examination today to determine his fitness to stand trial in Spain on charges of human rights abuses. The tests were expected to take most of the day. Pinochet's supporters have long said his health is too poor to withstand the rigors of a trial. The medical exam was requested by the Chilean government and accepted by the British Home Secretary, who ultimately must decide whether to extradite Pinochet to Spain or allow him to return home. Human Rights Watch said today that determining the state of Pinochet's health is very important because, quote, all criminal defendants must be able to participate in their own defense. This news from Sri Lanka. A suspected Tamil rebel detonated explosives strapped to her body while police tried to search her near the Prime Minister's office today, killing herself and 10 others. Hours later, gunmen assassinated a pro-Tamil politician. The Liberation Tigers of Tamil Eelam have been fighting for a separate homeland for the minority Tamil people since 1983. This news from New Hampshire. In a prelude to the latest debate with his Democratic presidential rival, Bill Bradley said Vice President Al Gore is campaigning in desperation and warned Democrats that Gore will be a weaker nominee because of his questionable 1996 fundraising tactics. Tonight will be the fourth debate between the two Democratic presidential contenders. It comes 3 weeks before the first 2000 primary on February 1st in New Hampshire, where Bradley is running stronger than anywhere else, at least according to polls. Meanwhile, Al Gore's bid for the presidency will get a boost from a Kennedy today. Breaking a long-standing tradition, Massachusetts Senator Edward Kennedy will endorse a candidate before the Democrats' nominating convention. According to Kennedy aides, his decision to endorse Gore comes after reflecting over the Christmas holiday and a telephone conversation with the vice president after New Year's. The Kennedy camp says the endorsement should not be viewed as a slap against Bill Bradley.
Shots ring out in a barroom night. Enter Betty Valentine from the upper hall. She sees a bartender in a pool of blood. Cries out, my God, they killed them all. Here comes the story of the hurricane. The man the authorities came to blame for something that he never done. Put in a prison cell, but what? Champion of the world. Three bodies lying near this Patty seat, and another man named Bello moving around mysteriously. I didn't do what he says, and he throws up his hands. I was only robbing the register. I hope you understand. I saw him leave, and he says, and he stops. One of us had better call up the cops. And so Patty calls the cops. And he arrive on the scene with their red lights flashing and a hot New Jersey night.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, joined by Juan Gonzalez. Welcome, Juan.
Good day, Amy, and to our listeners around the country. And amazing news today with the Attica decision. I know all of the former inmates and the lawyers are gratified after such a long struggle that most people had forgotten. They've finally gotten a victory.
That's right. This is truly a historic moment, coming 25 years after this class action civil suit was filed on behalf of close to 1,300 prisoners over the storming of the Western New York Attica prison by state troopers. Although the money may sound like a lot, $8 million, if divided by all of them, though many, many have died, it would come to something like $6,000 apiece. There's no question that the suffering they endured during this period was enormous.
And that the lessons of that Attica should have taught the nation have not yet been learned, obviously, as the incarceration rate and the conditions in the prisons continue to get worse.
And the demands of the prisoners are not emphasized very much now, why there was an uprising to begin with. The same kinds of issues that are raised in prisons around this country today, issues of education and health care in the prisons, certainly a story that we continue to cover, not just as a historical footnote. But speaking about prisons and history and moving into the future, today we are going to speak with Reuben Hurricane Carter. Last night I had a chance to go to the movies in Times Square just after this new millennium has dawned, and got a chance to see The Hurricane, starring Denzel Washington, which is about the miraculous story of Reuben Hurricane Carter, one of the most dynamic prize fighters in boxing's golden era. From 1961 to 1966, the middleweight posted a record of 28 wins, 11 losses, and a draw. But all of that came to an abrupt end when Carter was arrested for triple murder in his hometown of Paterson, New Jersey. As we just heard, a part of the story that was immortalized by Bob Dylan in his song Hurricane. Well, Carter was wrongfully convicted by an all-white jury and sentenced to three consecutive life sentences. In 1974, Reuben Carter wrote his autobiography from prison, which is called The 16th Round, from Number One Contend. 2 years later, the New Jersey State Supreme Court overturned his conviction on the grounds that the authorities withheld material evidence from the defense, but he was convicted again in a second trial in 1976. In 1985, that conviction was overturned by a U.S. District Court judge who concluded that the state made an unconstitutional appeal to racial prejudice. And in 1988, the Passaic, New Jersey Prosecutor's Office dropped all charges against Reuben Hurricane Carter. While in prison, Carter was fiercely outspoken, refusing to subject himself to any of the prison regimens. He shunned the prison's food, insisted on keeping his gold watch, refused to wear prison-issued clothes. He was not only robbed of his freedom, but of his wife, whom he divorced to lessen her share of his torment, and of his eye, which he lost in a botched prison operation. Well, now a new book is out on the life of Hurricane Carter called Hurricane, The Miraculous Journey of Reuben Carter, and a movie called The Hurricane, starring Denzel Washington, which has propelled Reuben Carter once again to center stage.
I've heard your statements. I'll take them under consideration. Now, is there anything else that counsel wishes to add before I make my final ruling?
What are you doing? I want to say something. What do you mean? I need to say something.
Your Honor, my client, Mr. Carter, wishes to address the court.
Request granted.
Thank you. I was a prize fighter. My job was to take all the hatred and skill that I could muster and send a man to his destruction. And I did that. But Reuben Hurricane Carter is no murderer. 20 years I've spent locked up in a cage, considered a danger to society. Not treated like a human being. Not treated like a person. Counted 15 times a day. I serve my time in a house of justice, and yet there's no justice for me. So, I ask you to consider the evidence. Don't turn away from the truth. Don't turn away from your conscience. Please don't ignore the law. No, embrace that higher principle for which the law was meant to serve. Justice. That's all I ask for. Justice.
Reuben Hurricane Carter, played by Denzel Washington in the new movie, The Hurricane. And we are joined by Reuben Carter on the phone right now. He lives in Toronto, where he's now executive director of the Association in Defense of the Wrongly Convicted. Welcome to Democracy Now, Reuben
Carter.
Good
morning. Good morning. You know, that clip you just played had me choked up here.
How does it feel to be played by Denzel Washington?
Yes.
How does it feel?
Well, I tell you, I never knew until I saw Denzel up on the big screen there. I never really knew how good looking I was, you know? No, I think I am honored to the ultimate to have a consummate performer such as Denzel Washington portray my life story on the screen. It is miraculous. It is wonderful.
We know also that you have visited the White House recently.
Yeah.
What did you have a chance to talk to President Clinton at all? And did
that aspect of it is miraculous. See, my life is very magical, very very magical, and I see magic around me all the time. And even Jim Hurst's book, Hurricane: The Miraculous Journey of Reuben Carter. Why miraculous? Let me put it to you this way. For 20 years, I spent in prison, reviled as a triple racist murderer, condemned to history, repudiated by the courts, and left to die amid squander and humiliation in a maximum security prison, just narrowly escaping the electric chair. And then just 3 weeks ago, there I was, invited to the White House, sitting next to the President of the United States, the most influential person on this planet, engaging him in very serious conversation about critical issues in the world. So close to him that I could hear every breath he took. And on Monday, I'll be addressing the General Assembly of the United Nations. Now, if that's not miraculous, if I don't know what is. I'm just floating. I'm flying.
Reuben Carter, did you talk to the President about the death penalty?
I certainly did. But the conversation that President Clinton and I had was a conversation between President Clinton and I, and not for public consumption, actually. I mean, it was very confidential, the things that we were talking about, and therefore I cannot speak about that.
And, Reuben Carter, how satisfied are you overall with the portrayal of the events in your life in the film? I know there's been somewhat of a controversy. Selwyn Rabb in the New York Times, who was a reporter who initially, some years back, exposed some of the contradictions in your case, criticized the film somewhat for taking quite a bit of license with some of the facts in terms of how it was that you were eventually exonerated. But do you think that the factual problems, if there are any, are overcome by the importance of getting the overall message of what your case meant to the American public as a whole?
Well, I'd say it's very unfortunate that anyone would have any kind of objection to what's being portrayed on the film, because it is certainly accurate. Of course, with trying to tell someone's life, a 63-year life, in the constraints of a two-hour picture, of course you cannot include everything that is in there. And therefore, the objections that might come from this movie will all come from those who perhaps were involved at one point or another throughout my legal odyssey. So those objections will all come from very personally involved people who perhaps may not think that they received enough credit or that they didn't receive enough screen time or one thing or another like that. But the overall picture is that the public itself seems to be getting the message, and the message is one of perseverance. The message is one of overcoming obstacles. The message is one of going the distance, starting something and completing it to its fullest. In 1976, for example, we received a new trial based on recantations from the prosecution's two key witnesses, criminals themselves who were given a license to steal in the state of New Jersey, as well as a $10,000 reward, as well as being placed in the witness protection program, as well as given leniency for crimes committed by them, which would have landed them in jail for 90 years. And that's the story that Selwyn Rabb reported. And we received a new trial based on that, you see? But again, that retrial was simply regurgitated. The first trial was simply regurgitated in the second trial and made even more infamous by the fact that in the first trial in 1967, there was no motive as to why John Artis and I would commit these horrible crimes. No motive at all. Nobody asked the question or tried to answer the question. Why would two people, one the top-ranked middleweight contender in the world, and a 19-year-old student who had just graduated from high school and was on his way to college on a scholarship for football and track. Why would these two people in their own hometown, practically in their own neighborhoods, and me, I'm the hometown celebrity, I'm bald-headed and bearded and all of that. Why would we do such a thing in our own hometowns, undisguised or anything? Nobody asked that question. Just a second, please. But in 1976, at the retrial, the prosecution suddenly conjured up a motive. Out of a grab bag of chips, up popped racial revenge, racial hatred. And the moment that you insert an element like that into a trial with an all-white jury, with a white judge, a white prosecutor, white victims, white police officers, two petty white criminals, then there is no chance for fairness. Because what we're talking about is tribalism here. We're talking about white people judging two black men having been accused of killing four white people.
Reuben Carter, we have to break for stations to identify themselves, but we will come back with you and also find out what happened with John Artis, who was sentenced along with you. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll continue with Hurricane in a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez.
From that moment on, I decided to take control of my life. I made up my mind to turn my body into a weapon. Be a warrior scholar. I boxed. I went to school. I began reading W.E.B. Du Bois, Richard Wright.
Move, dear one! Move!
Reuben Hurricane Carter, played by Denzel Washington in the new film The Hurricane. And we are joined by Reuben Carter on the telephone right now, who runs the Association in Defense of the Wrongly Convicted living in Toronto, as he was released about 15 years ago after being twice convicted of a triple murder that he did not commit, and only after remarkable persistence and not giving up, a judge finally overturned that decision. Judge Sirica, well known for the Nixon. Not involved with Nixon, but Judge Sarikin.
Not John Sirica.
Sorry, got a little confused there. Overturned that decision, and I was being corrected by the lawyer who would know, Leon Friedman, who we're going to be talking to in just a minute. But Reuben Carter, what did happen to the man that you were sentenced with, John Artis, who was driving you in that white car that night when you were picked up by the police?
Oh, yes, John Artis. John Artis has always been the forgotten man of this duo. Because the police did not want John Artis, the police wanted me. And they got me anywhere they could get me. They wanted me off the streets. They wanted everybody off the streets. That was the order set down from the five-star general, J. Edgar Hoover, in his COINTEL program. Get rid of anybody who can help people get together, unity, enlighten people about self-protection. They said destroy, disrupt, and get rid of those people. And they were getting rid of those people. They got rid of Malcolm X. They got rid of Martin Luther King, Mega Evers, and a whole lot more. And they got rid of me, just as they got rid of Mumia Abu-Jamal on death row in Pennsylvania, Linda Peltier down there in Kansas, Odell Barnes Jr. down there in Texas, on death row in Huntsville, Texas. They were getting rid of all of us, and so they got rid of me. But John Artis, that youngster who never had any problems with the law ever before, who was an exemplary youngster and student, his mettle was tested from the very moment that the police stopped us on June 17th, 1966, where he was facing the electric chair for something that he couldn't possibly have done. And at every second, all he had to do was to say that Reuben Hurricane Carter, that loud-mouthed prize fighter, committed this crime. And John Artis was home free. His life would not be in jeopardy. Nothing like that. And he could go on with his life as he always did. But John Artis answered all of these responses year after year. The governor of the state of New Jersey took John Artis out of prison, brought him home, sat him down in front of his mother and father, and said, if you give us a statement that would incriminate Reuben Carter, we will have the governor guarantees that you'll be home right here to stay within 3 or 4 days. Well, John Artis' response to that was, my mother and father didn't teach me to lie. They taught me to tell the truth. See, John Artis is my hero. He preserved my life. All John had to do was to roll over, give up, give in, give out to these people, and I would be dead. There is no question. If ever there was a death penalty case anywhere in the world for two people to go into a bar and shoot four innocent people for no reason whatsoever, if ever there was a death penalty case, that was it.
Well, and Reuben Carter, you mentioned
turned over on me, I would not be talking to you.
You mentioned Mumia Abu-Jamal, and of course the listeners of Democracy Now! Know quite a bit about his case, and the parallels in terms not only of the marking of a person long before the alleged crime was even committed, and the subsequent refusals of the criminal justice system to deal with it are of course, striking. Have you had any communication, or also the way performers have been attacked for trying to raise funds or conduct performances in on behalf of Mumia, in the same way that Bob Dylan and others were criticized back in your time? Have you had any communication with Mumia? Or
I certainly have. As the executive director of the International Association in Defense of the Wrongly Convicted, based in Canada, Great Britain, and here in the United States, I have very close contact with Mumia Abu-Jamal. And all wrongful conviction cases, like Mumia's, like Leonard Peltier, like Odell Barnes in Texas, and like my own, and like every case that we ever approach of wrongful convictions, there is always the same elements involved. There's always jailhouse stool pigeons who are buying themselves way out of jail. There are always police officers who are looking for success, who are looking for promotions, who hone in on an individual, a target, and once they begin to target that person, then that person slowly begins to be marginalized in society. The media jumps on it and begin to isolate that individual. And then when the police finally come down on the individual, the public has been primed and ready to say, okay, it must have been something because he was in the papers all the time. He must have done something. You see what I mean? So it's very simple for the powers to be to manipulate, to hone out, to target someone, and then to slowly proceed to criminalize that person. Even though that person may not be a criminal at all, they will criminalize him, and then the society as a whole says, well, if he's in prison, he must have done something, because if he didn't do it, he wouldn't be in prison. I mean, but
we're going to speak with your lawyer and the writer who wrote the new book on you, Hurricane, The Miraculous Journey of Reuben Carter, in a minute.
But Amy?
Yes.
Just a second, please. You are speaking right now to Professor Leon Friedman, one of the foremost constitutional experts in the world. And you are also speaking to Jim Hurst, a very dignified, very righteous man. Who has researched my life to a hilt and walked through every door that he could find in my life, opened it, and wrote about what he found there. And he is an amazing writer. So he's a historian of my life.
Well,
thank you. That's what I wanted
to say. Before we go to them, I just wanted to wrap up by asking you, what kept you going for the almost two decades that you were in prison?
Well, Amy, the first decade, I devoted myself to studying the law. And my law has been, my ability with the law has been demonstrated through every court in the state of New Jersey as well as in the country, all the way up to the United States Supreme Court. But when the law did not help me and could not help me, in fact, put me back in prison, I understood that it wasn't the law that was going to do me any good. So I threw away all my law books, and I said, okay, I'm going to turn this prison into an unnatural laboratory for the human spirit. I'm going to find something that's above the law to take care of the law. And that's what I began to do. It is only that. Only that which was strong enough to allow me to remain above the level of a prison system so that when I was finally released, I would not come out of that prison as a raving maniac. You know what I mean? It is that little teeny something. I don't know what you call it. I don't know what it is. And it's certainly not me. See, all credit must go to this creator. All credit. And all the mistakes are mine. But it was only that which allowed me to survive and allowed my innocence to remain alive and allowed me to fight for my freedom, fight for my vindication. And we did. And we won. That's the miracle. Anything else that surrounds this is really irrelevant. The miracle is that ordinary people, just ordinary people, joining together for a common cause, for a common aim, one direction, one mind, one thought, one understanding can do extraordinary things. That's what this movie is. That's what my life has been about. And that's what prison taught me.
Reuben Hurricane Carter joining us on the telephone today.
Could really use a shower. You smell awful, Mr. Carter. Why don't you take a shower? Get you a decent cell with a bed, some food. Feel a lot better.
At what price do I take the shower?
What do you mean?
I mean, what do I put on after I take this shower that's going to make me feel so good?
What everyone else puts on. That's the rules.
Yeah, well, you can just take me on back down to the hole. Live with those.
Denzel Washington playing Reuben Carter in the new movie, The Hurricane. There's also a new book out by that name, Hurricane, The Miraculous Journey of Reuben Carter, which is written by James Hirsch. And Jim Hirsch is a former staff writer for the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times. We're also joined by Leon Friedman, who is one of the longtime attorneys for Reuben Carter and the Joseph Kushner Distinguished Professor of Civil Liberties Law at Hofstra Law School. We welcome you both to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Thank you.
Leon Friedman, I'd like to start asking, how did you get involved in the case? What made you and what made you persevere over so many years with the belief that Reuben Hurricane Carter was innocent?
Well, I got involved after the second conviction. Myron Beldock and Lou Steele were the trial lawyers on the second conviction, and after it was over, they thought they needed a third eye or voice on all of this, and they were very exhausted by the whole thing, so they asked me to come in and prepare the briefs and argue the appeals. And at that point, I had not met Reuben. I think the first time I met Reuben was in 1981 at a court hearing, but I had spoke to him on the phone. And Reuben is a great athlete, and like every great athlete, and you just heard it now, there's an intensity to him. He gives everything, gives up everything. And it's very catching. You know, the whole idea is here's somebody who really is straining every muscle to fight against the system, to fight against the injustice. I mean, there's no doubt in our mind, and the minute you looked at the facts, it was simply impossible to conclude, as Reuben says, that he would have done that. I mean, you know, among the other facts, there were three people in this car when it was first stopped. They were moving towards the Lafayette Bar, not away from the Lafayette Bar. The clothes that they were wearing didn't match the clothes that the perpetrators. The first eyewitness testimony was way off. They were both described as two tall, light-skinned Negroes. And the one thing Reuben is not is a tall, light-skinned Negro at the time, and he had a bald head. I mean, it was absolutely impossible, if you looked at the facts, to conclude it. But it was his intensity. And I will say that once the Canadians came into it, this is part of the story of the movie and the book, their devotion. So you have...
Explain what you mean by the Canadians.
Well, the movie in Jim Hirsch's book tells a story of how a group of Canadians living together in Canada came to Brooklyn on to test some energy-saving device. They met a young black teenager, Lesra Martin, who at that point could not read. He was illiterate. And they took a liking to him, and they thought that he really deserves an education, and they took him to Canada, and they gave him some books to read, and one of the books that he read, that he bought at a secondhand library sale, was The 16th Round by Reuben Carter. He became devoted to the book and devoted to Reuben's plight, and he wrote to Reuben, visited him in jail, and then brought his Canadian guardians down to New Jersey, and they came down for 3 years, 4 years, from 81 to 85, and they just did everything. They devoted themselves to Reuben's case. So there was an intensity, a devotion, a focusing of energy on this case that was just catching, and the lawyers, we just did the best job of our careers. We're very proud of what we did in this case, but it was Reuben's spirit and the spirit of the Canadians that really drove the whole case.
Well, when we come back, we'll find out what ultimately turned the judicial system in Reuben Carter's favor, in justice's favor. And we'll speak with the man who also got involved with Reuben, the writer of his latest book called Hurricane. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, and we'll be back in a minute.
Thank you.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez.
Hate put me in prison. Love's gonna bust me out.
Just in case love doesn't, I'm gonna bust you out of here.
Denzel Washington playing Reuben Hurricane Carter, speaking actually just before the judge's decision to Lezra Martin. Lezra Martin, the young man who took on the case. James Hirsch, you wrote the book Hurricane, The Miraculous Journey of Reuben Carter, and wrote extensively about Lezra, who himself now is an attorney. Is that right?
Yes, he's actually a prosecutor in Western Canada, which is ironic, of course, because the prosecutors were the adversaries in Reuben's life. But Lezra's position is that a good prosecutor can prevent a wrongful conviction by not going after the wrong person to begin with.
And James Hirsch, for those folks who are listening who are not familiar with the essential facts of the case, could you give us a quick summary of how Carter was originally arrested and what the case, how it resounded at that time in the context of the arrest?
Well, of course, the murders occurred in 1966 when passions were quite high in the United States over the civil rights movement and racial tensions, and that really provided the backdrop of this case, because the murders occurred in Patterson, in which two black men walked into a bar and shot four people, killing three, including a woman. And there were enormous political pressures at the time that they had to find the killers. There was a murder earlier that night of a black person by a white person, and the second shooting was seen as retaliation for the first shooting. So you had this specter.
That's because all the victims were white?
Yes, in the second shooting, all the victims were white. So you had this specter of black mob vigilanteism, and that, of course, was a very haunting specter to the white establishment of Patterson, New Jersey. So that began Patterson's search for the killer, and it took them to the most feared man in Patterson, and that was Reuben Hurricane Carter. He had a reputation in Patterson. He was a former convict at the time. He was very flamboyant. He was very outspoken. Because of his whole hurricane persona, he became the ruthless face of black militancy. So the facts of the case were sort of long and contorted, but I think the important part was that the perception was that he looked like a killer, he sounded like a killer, so he probably was a killer. And Reuben's problem has been that in the court of public opinion, he always faced not so much the weight of the evidence, but the burden of perception.
Mm-hmm. And so he was convicted twice of a triple murder.
Right. The first conviction occurred in 1967. That conviction was overturned by the state Supreme Court on the grounds that prosecutors withheld material evidence. Reuben was retried, reconvicted for the same crime, and then that conviction was also overturned by a federal judge who also concluded that the state had withheld evidence and appeal to racial prejudice.
Then, Leon Friedman, describe your change strategy and what ultimately led you to the judge, Sorokin, who ultimately overturned this decision. What was the approach?
Well, it wasn't a change strategy. In other words, the racial revenge motive was in the second trial, and Lou Steele strenuously objected to it. It was held in contempt for objecting to it because there was no predicate for racial revenge. So that was always one of the arguments we had from day one. What was different was the chief eyewitness, this burglar named Bello, had told various versions of where he was when the crime occurred. He was given a lie detector test, and the lie detector test said one thing, but the test ended up indicating the opposite. And what happened was that the lie detector expert told the authorities exactly what the lie detector meant, but the report was jumbled, and we still don't know why it ended up that way. But Myron Beldock, who was his trial lawyer, called up the lie detector expert after the trial and said, what were the results of this test? And the lie detector expert told him, which was the opposite of what his report had done. Again, this is very complicated. But that was the so what they did the second time was exactly what they did the first time, which is withhold evidence. Now, what happened was we went through the New Jersey state system, and at that time we could then go into the federal court on what's called a writ of habeas corpus and ask a federal judge to examine any constitutional errors. And at the time, and this is quite important and very topical, we were able to do that. A federal judge could take a fresh look at the trial and decide whether it was constitutional or not. Since that time, Congress passed a law in 1996, signed by President Clinton, and there are a whole bunch of ironies on all of this, and now the United States Supreme Court is about to hand down a case, very important case, on whether federal judges must give a very heavy deference to whatever the state courts do. So I keep saying, and I think it's true, that if Rubin were coming today, if his case came up today, he probably would still be in jail.
And is it true the risk that Rubin Carter took and that you took in taking this to a federal judge because you had new evidence, and if he didn't accept this, the evidence would have to be thrown out and could never be considered by a court again?
Well, that's true. There was a fight among the lawyers about we found the new evidence, the so-called material in the Caruso file. But in order to present it to a federal judge, we had to present it through all levels of the court system, and that would have taken another 2 years. And I kept saying, let's go into federal court now, and eventually Rubin sided with me. And the consequence of doing that is that all this new evidence would simply be wiped out for all purposes.
Let's hear the movie version of Hurricane, the judge's decision.
All rise. This Federal District Court in New Jersey is now in session. Judge Sirica presiding. This court does not arrive at its conclusion lightly. On one hand, Rubin Carter has submitted a document alleging racial prejudice, coercion of testimony, and withholding of evidence. On the other hand, Mr. Carter was tried twice by two different juries, and those convictions were subsequently upheld by the New Jersey State Supreme Court.
He's going to rule against us. Rubin's going to lose.
However, the extensive record clearly demonstrates to this court that Rubin Carter's conviction was predicated upon an appeal to racism rather than reason, and concealment rather than disclosure. To permit convictions to stand which have as their sole foundation appeals to racial prejudice is to commit a violation of the Constitution as heinous as the crimes for which the defendants were tried and convicted. I hereby order Rubin Carter released from prison.
And that is Rod Steiger playing U.S. District Court Judge H. Lee Sorokin. And that was the decision in 1985, the conviction of Hurricane Carter overturned. What were your thoughts at that moment, Leon Friedman?
Well, we had good feelings from the oral argument on, so everybody was very positive about it. Rubin, by the way, and Jim Hirsch tells the story very well, was so confident that he started giving away all of his possessions. He gave away his books. He gave away his everything that made life bearable. He kept giving it away as the time came. And on the very last day, he was down to what? The clothes that he
That's
wore?
That's it. The clothes on his back.
The clothes on his back. And Jim says in his book, when a prisoner does that, there are only two things that are possible. Well, you describe it.
Right. It shows that the prisoner is either going to be going home, the prisoner, or that the prisoner is going to commit suicide, or that the prisoner is crazy. And Reuben, of course, was the first one.
Jim Hirsch, I'd like to ask you to talk a little bit about the relationship between art and reality, between the film and the reality of Reuben Carter's life. Carter has said himself that you are the consummate biographer of him, that you've looked into every aspect of his life. And, of course, Denzel Washington is already getting rave reviews, and he's really one of the great actors of our time. What is your sense of how the film captures the story of Hurricane Carter and where it may actually, if it does at all, do any disservice to the reality of the facts?
Well, first of all, I didn't research and write the book to sort of be a critic of the film. All I can say is that I think people should see the film. It's a very powerful vehicle to tell Reuben's story. And anything that sheds light on his life or stimulates discussion about his experiences is good, and the film does that. My advantage as a writer is that I could tell Reuben's story in much more depth and detail and nuance than the filmmakers can. As Reuben has now said many times, the filmmakers were simply constrained by the limits of their medium. They couldn't tell the story in full. They had to consolidate and make certain changes. And the filmmakers can defend their film, but I'm not going to criticize it.
Reuben Carter had written his own autobiography, The 16th Round, from number one contender to number 45472, and that was the book that young Lester Martin read and got him interested in his case. But it was the book he wrote when he was still in prison.
Right.
It must have been a little frightening for you to take on this case and have Carter as your number one critic. What was that like when he read the manuscript?
Reuben does not trust many people. By instinct, he keeps everyone at arm's length. He's been betrayed many times in his life, and I realized that very early on, that it was going to take a long time to build up any trust with Reuben and develop a rapport and get him to open up about his life. In the book, I chronicle his triumphs as well as his mistakes, and I depict a pretty gritty story of Reuben. So when I sent him the manuscript, I was nervous about what he was going to say. He didn't have editorial control of the book, but obviously it was important to me that he thought that I captured his life, both the facts and the spirit of his story. And so I sent him the book, and Reuben likes to call people very late at night, and the phone rings at 1 a.m. One morning. I roll out of bed, and I pick up the phone, and it's Reuben, and he says, Jim, I just want you to know that I'm getting ready to start your book. And I said, well, that's fine, Reuben. I hope you enjoy it, and good night. So I go back to bed, and a half hour later, the phone rings again. I roll out of bed, and it's Reuben, and he's in a state of high excitement. He says, Jim, I just want you to know I've read the first chapter, and I think it's wonderful. You're very clever. I see where you're going with this story. And he goes on in this vein. And finally I said, Reuben, I'm glad you liked it, but you don't have to call me after each chapter. Reuben reads the manuscript three times, and to his credit, he did not ask for a single change. And when he said to me, Jim, this book is a roadmap to enlightenment, I knew that I had realized a very important goal for myself, and that Reuben accepted the book.
James Hirsch, author of Hurricane, The Miraculous Journey of Reuben Carter. Very briefly, what did you think were some of the mistakes?
Well, Reuben makes no bones about the fact that when he, particularly when he was a prize fighter in the 1960s, he caroused a lot, he was a womanizer, he had a reputation not undeserved as a bully. He often made intemperate remarks to the press about racism in America. I mean, it's one thing to be a critic of the system, but Reuben went beyond that and made some ill-advised remarks that simply, seemed to make him more angry and more radical than he really was. He's not easy to get close to, and over the years, Reuben has turned his back on a lot of people who have tried to help him, just because, you know, Reuben had to fight for his freedom, and if you could help him win his freedom, he would embrace you. But once you couldn't help him, he would turn his back, and I describe all of that.
He also said that he had to close down that hope, or he couldn't live anymore. He describes, or at least that's the movie version, having been to the movie last night. At the end, Leon Friedman, you've won this case, but now almost 2 million people are in prison in this country. And as you pointed out, under the current system, it may well be that if Reuben Carter were in prison today, you couldn't have gotten him out using the same strategy that you used. What are your final thoughts?
Well, my final thought is that the death penalty has poisoned not only politics in the United States, because everybody runs on the death penalty, but it's poisoned the legal system, so that we're making legal changes in habeas corpus and the way in which cases are presented that affect everything. There's such an irrational drive to complete the death penalty, to impose it, that anything in the way of the fastest possible execution is really perverting the whole system. So Reuben is very conscious of this, and he's out there fighting the death penalty, and that really is one of the most poisonous parts of the system today.
He put me in prison. Love's gonna bust me out.
Reuben Hurricane Carter. That does it for today's program. Our guests have been Reuben Carter himself, as well as James Hirsch, his biographer. The book is called Hurricane, The Miraculous Journey of Reuben Carter. It's published by Houghton Mifflin. And we've been joined by one of the longtime attorneys of Reuben Carter, Leon Friedman, a professor of civil liberties law at Hofstra Law School in New York. By the way, this latest news, and that is INS officials say the father of 6-year-old Cuban Elian Gonzalez has a right to custody of the boy. And that does it for today's program. If you'd like to order a cassette copy, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. You can write to us at democracy@pacifica.org. And you can go to our websites at www.pacifica.org or www.democracynow.org. And you can listen to the program and tell your friends in places that don't air Democracy Now! That they too can hear the program. Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion, David Love, and Karen Palmer. Our technical director is Errol Maitland. From the studios of WBAI in New York, I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!